You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
I've been saying for the last year and a half that the best thing we can do, politically speaking, is let Obamacare explode. It is exploding right now.
But not in the way Donald Trump might have hoped. We'll look at why the US and the Republican Party is so divided over the current president's healthcare plans. My guests, Michael Binion and Stephen DL, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including why the US and Russia are now squabbling over property, along with all the other stuff. And we'll also focus on the latter's approach to religious freedom. Plus, has austerity in the UK led to shorter lifespans? Let's hope not. We've got 30 minutes to fill. That's all ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed Michael Binion, former affairs specialist for The Times, foreign affairs specialist, I should correctly say, and Stephen DL, writer, broadcaster and Russia analyst. They're both very much current specialists, I should stress. Let's start with President Donald Trump's attempt to repeal his predecessor Barack Obama's Affordable Health Care Act, known as Obamacare. Well, it's taken another knock in the past 24 hours. Republican senators Jerry Moran of Kansas and Mike Lee of Utah have withdrawn support for the repeal bill. It's left the future of one of Trump's core policies in doubt and the very unity of the Republican Party looking shakier still. Michael Binion, is Obamacare going to haunt Trump's entire first term?
Well, it looks like it, yes. It was the very much the thing that he promised to be the priority when he got into power, and it's his vaunted ambition that he's going to get rid of what he thought was a sort of socialized medicine and put in place something that would be better, that wouldn't have Obama's fingerprints all over it. And nobody seems to want the replacement. And he's left with some very difficult options. One is either to simply scrap what they've got now and have nothing in its place, which for a lot of people would be disastrous, or to try to scrabble together some alternative plan which they could put in place as soon as Obamacare was repealed. The problem is the Republicans themselves cannot agree on what should be the alternative.
Well, and on that very point, it's instructive, is it not, Stephen, that the Republicans are so divided. You have some of those who've opposed this because they feel it's excessive, and others who feel it doesn't go in any way far enough. It shows you how riven the Republican Party is on this.
Not only how riven the Republican Party is, but also, I think, how naive and simplistic Donald Trump is in many of the things he says and tries to do. As Michael said, you know, this was one of his big things, if not his biggest thing, that even in the campaign and since he became elected. But it's, you know, it's one of these things that he seems to not to have understood just how complicated it is. And there's this wonderful video that was sent round on Twitter a few months ago where he said he starts off by saying, you know, and no one understood how complicated healthcare could be. And then you've got about six times in different situations Obama saying, now let me tell you, healthcare is really complicated. And it, to my mind, it just, you know, the naivety of the man, of Trump, is staggering.
Well, in terms of staggering naivety, then, perhaps the best expression of that in terms of his recent pronouncements on this is, Michael, precisely as you said, that he has now sort of threatened effectively to simply repeal it with no replacement whatsoever, which shows extraordinary moxie and also no little political naivety. That surely can't happen.
Well, that can't happen because there are some Republicans who depend very much on the votes of those people who would be left completely uncovered if the Obamacare was repealed, and they would simply not vote for the senator or the congressman who was a Republican who voted for that. So they are pretty sensitive to what public opinion on the ground thinks. Now, sure, a lot of people think that it's expensive, it needs changing, it needs adjusting. In fact, even Democrats think that there needs to be some tweaks to it. But simply repealing it would be absurd because having put in place, and it's probably the last Western industrialized democracy that's got some kind of state health care or some kind of universal care, having put it in place, to suddenly leave the country without any kind of safety net would be very, very difficult. And the problem is that Donald Trump hasn't put in the work on this. Nearly all bills run into difficulties from at one stage or another, and the president has to really go around Congress lobbying those people who are going to support what he wants, twisting their arm, promising them something, mastering the details himself and taking a close interest. Now, Trump has not done that, and as Stephen says, he's rather naively just thought, well, I'll throw it out there and, you know, it'll get through.
And I think that's what also what he seems to not to have realised that he is not actually a dictator. He seemed to think in the whole campaign and since he's been elected that what he says goes. And actually, you know, you've got senators and you've got Congress who actually have some say in this as well. And that, you know, I think it is as simple as that. He's a simplistic man and he doesn't understand the complications, not just of healthcare, but of just about anything he touches.
Michael, I'm interested in picking up on that point you made about members of the House or Senate who could become under pressure were they seen to support the repeal of the bill without a fully worked replacement or any sort of replacement. We've talked a bit before about how Trump has this Teflon veneer and his core out in the US heartlands doesn't really seem or hasn't thus far been affected by some of his errors or mistakes or mispronouncements that he's made. They'd certainly be unhappy with their immediate local representatives were that scenario to unfold. Would that threaten Trump? I mean, the numbers over 30 million Americans, I think, who would immediately have no health cover if it were repealed without a replacement. Surely even Trump wouldn't risk. One wonders whether he'd be that concerned about those other members of the Republican rank and file, but it would affect him too, would it not?
Well, actually, not that much, because Trump himself is not really beholden to the Republican Party at all. In fact, he's the insurgent who came to power despite the Republican Party. And they suddenly, I mean, most of them, and certainly the leading senators and congressmen, were deeply against him during the whole nomination campaign. And then even after he'd been nominated, some senior people said they wouldn't have anything to do with him and more or less announced that they weren't going to vote for him. So I don't think he really cares very much what the fate of individual Republicans are, particularly not those he sees as enemies. Yes, it might affect him in the long term in that people would say, well, surely the president, you know, can't let us down like this. In the short term, it would rebound against the individual Republicans who voted for something like this. Mm. And again, in the long term, he does, as you say, have a sort of Teflon coating that if he can deliver one or two other things, a few more jobs or the perception of a few more jobs, then I think his core supporters won't be too bothered and they'll stick with him through quite a lot.
Stephen, this is a bit of a broad question, and one sense is with healthcare in the States that it's not really a matter of perception management like it is in some of the other areas perhaps that Michael's alluding to. There does seem to be a very large demographic in the States who believe this, that any form of state healthcare is some kind of socialist conspiracy. Why does that endure so powerfully in the States? Because in most other Western countries you look at, there's some sort of approximation, maybe even a broad consensus that something needs to be there. Why is it such a vexing issue in the US?
It's a great question, and it's one I ask myself often. Seriously, when speaking to Americans, I mean, I'm thinking, you know, going back 35 years when I was telling some Americans I happened to meet about National Health Service in Britain, and they looked aghast, and I looked aghast at their looking aghast, and said, well, what? And they said, well, but you know, that's socialism, you know, the state providing healthcare. No, we provide our own. And as you're saying, it has survived for a lot of people. I can't give you an answer to the question because I do find it vexing myself. To my mind, you know, in a modern civilized country, if you know, if someone has a dreadful accident or whatever, the you know, the first thing that the question they shouldn't be asked is, you know, where's your credit card? It should be, you know, as with the National Health Service, God bless it in Britain, that the health service will look after you, and if there are complications, whatever, you know, there can be questions asked about funding or whatever. But you know, I mean, a doctor has an obligation to treat a patient, no matter what nationality, creed, colour, anything else that they are. That is in the Hippocratic Oath. So I really can't understand why so many Americans are appalled by the idea of this. And I agree with Michael that, you know, there are these diehard Trump supporters who, you know, who might have a go at their local senator or whatever, but somehow on this one, for now anyway, Trump seems to be out of the immediate firing line.
Michael, any advance from you on that big question as to why, you know, they're very happy with collective funding of the military or the road network or any other number of other things?
Well,
is it very expensive. Is it a historical thing?
Or? It is partly historical. Don't forget that the doctors' lobby is a pretty big and powerful lobby, and doctors can become very rich in the States. Mind you, they pay an absolute fortune in insurance because the cult or the practice of suing doctors for almost anything. I mean, malpractice is a fine way to make money in America. But the fact is that doctors are not particularly keen on being reimbursed by the state. They think that it's like a sort of private enterprise thing. And that was the case in a lot of countries before they introduced a national health service. I mean, it was the same in Britain. And in 1948, most doctors were deeply against the national health service. And it was only only possible to get it through because the then health minister, Nyren Bevin, said he would stuff their mouths with gold and shut them up, which he did.
And there was, I guess, a broad consensus, a post-war thing. Maybe a heavy defeat is what you need to galvanise the political will. If the pressures of running a government are all getting a bit much, you could just do away with a large chunk of one of the government's most prominent offices. US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is reportedly looking to shut down the US State Department's office that focuses specifically on war crime. The Office of Global Criminal Justice, as it's known, may soon have its staff reassigned. Stephen, on this point, is Rex Tillerson doing some, I don't know what you'd call it, but a practical downsizing? I'd be familiar with a man who's run a big corporation before. Is he fundamentally questioning what the reach of the State Department should be?
I think quite possibly it's the latter. He's questioning what the role should be. But it also, as soon as I heard this one, it rang a bell in my own mind with a conversation I had with an American shortly after Trump was elected. And he said, don't expect the words human and rights to appear together in many of the pronouncements from this administration. And that seems to me it's a case of that. Maybe the department is too, I'm trying to play the devil's advocate here, maybe the department is too big and so there will be only a couple of people looking at it. But to do away with it completely would be extraordinary, I think. As you say, Tillerson is he's a man who's come from big business, and so he's not averse to sacking people or reappointing them. But to do away with a department which looks at war crimes, genocide, is there a relation to looking back to the Holocaust, and which actually Holocaust education is very strong in America, and he needs that there's a very strong Jewish lobby as well. There's a massive Holocaust museum in Washington. I can see a lot of alarm bells being rung if this does go through.
And Michael, it's interesting, isn't it? Even if the rationale might be that, look, it's time to focus purely on America's economic interests, that might be a narrative that sits more comfortably with Rex Tillerson precisely because of his background in the boardroom. That's also, though, rather naive, isn't it? If you focus on economic interests, you need to have a more rounded view. You need to look at all these things holistically. Surely that's absolutely the thing that the State Department should be looking at.
Well, yes, and probably the State Department itself is not that happy with this decision. But I have to say, there is a logic to the decision, because I don't think the Americans have ever actually accepted the International Court. They haven't signed up to it. So if you don't accept the fact that you can have trials on in international jurisdictions, then what's the point of having people investigating war crimes if you're not going to participate in the process of justice afterwards? It's always been a bit of an odd thing. I mean, the Americans feel that this would actually make all American military and possibly political personnel overseas subject to arbitrary arrest on trumped-up war crimes charges. That's been their objection to it, and particularly military personnel. So they don't really accept the idea of international justice. They say individual states should organise their trials and their justice system. I think also there is a practical argument to make that there are so many positions still unfilled in the State Department that the thing is running on half empty at the moment. So you probably need to rake in people from wherever you can and concentrate them in the fields where there really is something to do.
Well, and Stephen, that's a very good point that Michael makes there. Morale is supposedly at a sort of all-time low in the State Department. There's very little despite the fact that people are being reassigned amongst senior personnel, apparently there's not much lateral movement anymore, which has contributed to this feeling. Is there a danger that even if this is only, I don't know, one administration's worth, lasting damage can be done in terms of the function and, I guess, the global perception of the State Department?
The function and the global perception, yes. I mean, I don't know what the exact figure is, but a number of ambassadors still haven't been appointed. For example, in the UK, there still isn't an American ambassador since Trump took over. It sends out a very strange message to the world that and to certain individual countries. You know, is it, you know, well, we don't really care about your country, or it also sends out the message that this administration is in a mess. And I just, you know, I keep saying, well, I can't see Trump lasting the full term. And he goes on and on so far. Let's see. It's wherever you look, there's just so many problems, gaps, gaffes. It's extraordinary.
I wouldn't say that the State Department itself is in a mess. Yes, it's true, lots have left. But I think Tillerson is doing the best kind of catch-up job he can do. Mm. I mean, his boss comes out with some very strange pronouncements, and then he has to go and try and sort things out. Take, for example, the Gulf at the moment, the Saudi-Qatar quarrel. Now, Tillerson is left right in the middle of this, trying to sort it out. And from all appearances, he's been quite statesmanlike and thoughtful in what he's tried to do to calm things down and get both sides. So I think the State Department is put in this terribly difficult position of trying to sort out what is a general mess from the top and continue American policy in a way that is somewhat more predictable and somewhat more reliable.
Well, let's stay stateside in the US and look at another Obama policy that's causing the current administration some headaches. Yesterday, talks ended unresolved between Russia and the United States, which were aimed at resolving a property dispute between the two. The Russians aren't happy that some prime US real estate was seized by their hosts, two diplomatic compounds in New York, Maryland, as part of sanctions placed on Russia by the Obama administration. Their seizures, along with the expulsion of I think 36 Russian diplomats, were in reaction to alleged Russian vote meddling that took place during last year's election. Stephen Dale, is Russia just wanting its buildings back?
It's wanting its buildings back, and it also wants to stress that it had nothing to do with meddling in the US elections, which is just an example of Russian disinformation, because we all know now that they did meddle in the Russian elections. You know, that's another one we haven't mentioned when we're talking about Trump's problems. Obamacare might be, forgive the pun, trumped by the Russia question yet, and the latest revelations involving Trump's son and the meeting he had with Russians and so on. But it's very difficult at the moment for anyone to have serious discussions with the Russians when you know that they're actually not telling the truth about something. In this case, that oh no, they say we didn't meddle in the American elections. The Americans took these properties away and expelled the diplomats as a punishment, and now they're saying we want the properties back. Well, the reason they were taken away still remains, that there was meddling in the elections, and so they might retaliate. I think the Americans would say, well, so what? So, you know, they could expel some American diplomats. Which
is that what this prospective retaliation might look like then, as tit for tat gesture, property?
It could be. It would look rather strange, because normally in the past tit for tat has happened pretty quickly. Hmm. Gorbachev, actually, when the Americans expelled, I think it was 105 Russian diplomats in the late 80s. And Gorbachev responded in quite a cunning way. I think it was 1987. Instead of expelling American diplomats, he withdrew all the Soviet, as it was then, personnel who were working in the American embassy in Moscow, which made the running of the embassy really difficult. The Americans sent out a plea to anyone who spoke any Russian at all in America, please come in. You know, do you want a job in Moscow? Which was quite a clever way of dealing with it. A lot of people said, oh, back in December, when Obama closed these places and expelled the diplomats, they said, oh, look, Putin has reacted very calmly. He hasn't expelled people. Putin can bide his time over things. Mm. So I thought at the time we haven't seen the end of this one, and clearly we haven't. There has been talk in the meantime of the buildings being given back, but obviously it hasn't been resolved yet. Something I can't see if it's now been ratcheted up again. I can't see the Russians just letting it go away now. If there is no movement, they will probably feel they have to do something to show that they are strong too.
Michael, just briefly on this, we've talked about the workings of the State Department. We've talked about this latest sort of iteration of the Russia-America tension. Given where we're at broadly in terms of Russo-American relations, what should the sort of diplomatic playbook look like between the two? Because it feels like rather uncharted territory.
Yes, I've got some sympathy for the Russians on this question of the property and the buildings. It is actually quite a lonely job being a Russian in America, and equally lonely, probably almost more so, being an American diplomat in Russia. And they do need these places, and especially this used to be the case in the Cold War, where you weren't allowed to travel around and you couldn't meet people and things like that. They need sort of little enclaves where they can go and relax and have picnics and, you know, swim and whatever. And they had these rather nice sort of country dachas, as they would see it, very much part of the sort of Russian psyche. Had them suddenly taken away, they were pretty aggrieved by that. And I think it really is very petty not to find a way of resolving this. Now, in the bigger picture, I think the Trump administration would like better relations with Russia. But the problem is he's held hostage on this by this whole murky business of whether or not there was some Russian interference in the election. I think if he can get to a better relationship, and Tillerson also would like that because he knows Russia quite well, I think that would be a good thing. But it is, at the moment, objectively quite difficult. I would have thought they could certainly have come to some agreement just on this question of these buildings.
Indeed. You're listening to the insights there of Michael Binion, Stephen Diel, and I'm your host, Tom Edwards. Coming up next on Midori House, more from Russia, we'll be talking religion, and we'll get a health check for the United Kingdom.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Hong Kong, our bureau chief is James Chambers.
There's no such thing as an ordinary day in Hong Kong. On any one day, I may be interviewing a city mayor or having coffee with a hotelier or chatting with an interior designer and then trying out the latest bar or restaurant. And mixed in with all of this, there'll be some wacky or outrageous news coming out of China which deserves to be covered on the radio. So it's this variety that I really love about the job.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. Still with me are Michael Binion and Stephen Diel. Russia's Supreme Court has ordered the disbanding of the religious group the Jehovah's Witnesses on Russian soil. The move follows legislation introduced in April that labelled Jehovah's Witnesses as extremists. Appeals were lodged, but those have now failed. The denomination is said to have over 175,000 members in Russia and has also suffered persecution there during the Soviet era. Stephen Diel, well, who are the Jehovah's Witnesses and why specifically is Russia treating them this way?
Well, the Jehovah's Witnesses are the Jehovah's Witnesses as they are around the world. Some people love them, some people hate them, some people get very annoyed with them knocking on your door and trying to convert you. They do no more in Russia than they do in other countries. But I think it's a sign of how the Russian Orthodox Church is having great influence on Russian policy, but also is in bed with the Kremlin. And it's part of this Russianness that President Putin has put forward. Many years ago, I was making a program in Russia where I interviewed an Orthodox priest who said, our great writer Dostoevsky said that if you are not Orthodox, you cannot be Russian. And it's the truth. And there are people who believe that. And so they see any other religion as a threat. Many Russians and many Orthodox Russians. There's an extraordinary film of a police raid on an Jehovah's Witness prayer house, and it you know, they're in balaclavas, they're armed. You'd think that they were going after some hardened criminals. And the Jehovah's Witnesses say, we're just, you know, we're doing as Jehovah's Witnesses do. We take the Bible at face value and we're trying to preach the Bible. I'm afraid it's just yet another example of modern Russian intolerance of anything that doesn't fit the Kremlin's playlist.
And Michael, I guess that's the key point, isn't it? That curtailing of religious freedoms in this style, whatever reservations you may or may not have about the group in question, it's a negative development, and it often tends to precede worse along the same lines.
Yes, I have to say what's important about the Jehovah's Witnesses or any of these Protestant groups is that they tend to have their loyalties, or Russians think they have their loyalties, outside the country. And that's what annoys them particularly. And in fact, I remember in Soviet times being taken on a tour of Ukraine to go and look at Ukrainian Baptists. And this was being taken by the sort of KGB minders who are in charge of sort of religious affairs in Russia. And they were showing me all these Protestants. They didn't like them because, first of all, they didn't drink, and they thought that wasn't very Russian. And secondly, they thought that they owed their loyalty not to the Russian state, to the Soviet state, but to Southern Baptists in America. And they thought that they were somehow fifth columnists. And one of these guys, the KGB minders, he said to me, you know, I'm an atheist, but I'm an Orthodox atheist. And that was the point, that Russia feels that, you know, it's part of their identity that Russian Orthodox looks to Mother Russia, and Jehovah's Witnesses certainly don't.
And I guess even on the broader point, people say, look, you know, this is what we see in increasingly totalitarian states, and so, you know, gear up for more of the same. I guess it's motivated by that, the suspicions that Michael talks about there. But is it, in a sense, par for the course?
Yes, it is. I fully agree with Michael. It's this idea that they're not Russian and they're not looking to Russia. And if I were a Russian who subscribed to a non-Orthodox religion, so Catholics or other Protestants or whatever, I think I'd be rather worried. They probably won't take on the Catholic Church because they probably feel that they'll tolerate it. There aren't many Catholics in Russia anyway. But these, what they see as smaller sects and cults, as they describe them, Seventh-day Adventists, for example, I wouldn't be at all surprised if we heard that that they were having a hard time. Baptists, as Michael mentioned, to those of us of a Western liberal mind, it is another worrying development in modern Russia.
Well, I would just add the problem in Russia is that all cults tend to be more cultist than they are anywhere else. And even if they're just what we would have thought, sort of moderate Baptists, they become very fanatical. And we've seen this Russia is a great place for cults. That people adopt them very easily and quickly. And we saw this with this rather sinister Japanese group, Aon Shinriko, the ones that poisoned people in the underground in Tokyo. They had a huge following in Russia. That was the second biggest place where the cult existed. And the Russians are always aware that these rather strange mystical cults, they pop up all over the place. And I think there is a genuine worry about them.
It was particularly the case after the breakup of the Soviet Union. I remember making a program in 1992 and meeting some people from a mystical cult who were travelling the country and getting packed houses to listen to their message. And perhaps that's a backlash of 70 years of atheism being drummed down people's throats, that people have reached out to other things to satisfy some spiritual need, but it does worry the Orthodox.
Very briefly, before the show ends, I want to talk about a new piece of research from a former UK government advisor on the links between poverty and ill health, suggesting life expectancy here in the UK has stalled since 2010, when the austerity programme was really enforced. Michael Binion, if you put pressure on the things that improve quality of life for a nation, a shorter lifespan results. It's the logical consequence.
Well, I think this is tosh, actually. I mean, your lifespan isn't determined by the last 6 years of your life. It's mostly determined by the first 6 years of your life. And in fact, I'm extremely lucky because I was born during the Second World War when there was rationing. And people say, well, that must have been terrible. You know, people were hungry. Actually, it was the best possible start children could have because they had the right food given in the right amounts at the right time. And that's what makes the difference. Now, to blame it all on austerity, this is absolute nonsense. And make the point, it's not that life expectancy is falling, it's just not getting greater as fast as
at
it was before.
Stephen, a very, very brief word to you, maybe just a one or two word tip. What is the Stephen DL secret for longevity?
Well, my aim is to live forever, and so far so good.
And who can possibly argue with that? Gentlemen, thank you both very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. Thanks to Stephen Diehl and to Michael Binion. Today's programme was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Christy Evans. My thanks to all of them. More music for you next at 1900. Josh is here with Section D, looking at the world of design. And Emma will have more on the big stories of the day for you, interpreted in fine Monocle style on the Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 London time. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening.